politics without the soap opera, with unfiltered constitutional conservative truth. The Conservative Review with Daniel Horowitz.
And welcome back, fellow American patriots and Minutemen standing at the ready to fight anew for our life, liberty, and property, everything that matters, stuff that our forefathers could have never imagined being in play. Transhumanism, we're nothing but a bunch of Neanderthals with iPhones. Why are we a bunch of Neanderthals with iPhones? What could we do about that? In the era we live in, when so much is out of our hands, we don't have political dominion, political leadership, representation. What can we do? And that's really the catchphrase of this show. And that's why I want you to send today's show and every show to your friends, relatives, and anyone who is intrigued by something new and forward-looking. Again, back here today for April 2nd. It's another one of those dreary days. We got like three of them in a row here in the eastern part of the country. But as they say, April showers bring May flowers. You know, you gotta what you sow in tears, you reap in joy. So you gotta work for everything. It's kind of a metaphor for where we are politically. Now, we've talked a lot about local activism, making red states red. We're gonna continue talking about that. But ultimately, the most local unit of government is the family. And while we might look out on the landscape, look at, you know, the presidency and the courts and Congress and legislatures and governors and think, you know, we barely have anyone representing us, we don't have control over those institutions, but we do have control over our own family. And then you kind of branch out a little bit, you get community, you get church. And that's a big part of where we need to wield our influence. And particularly today, I want to focus on one aspect of that: raising girls, raising the next generation of women. Yes, I really do think at its molecular form, the war on womanhood, the war on motherhood, really is at the core of the collapse of society. And that's everything: demographics, culture, economy, you name it. It all flows, in my view, from there. You know, it does tie very much into the decline of religiosity in the country. So the two go hand in hand: decline of the family, decline of religiosity. But that's really ultimately where I think we can make our imprint. And we need to ask ourselves, as conservatives, are we living the lives of conservatives? Are we encouraging our children to live that way? Are we modeling that behavior in our own lives? Are we really having a community of conservatives that get married at a reasonable age, have children, stay married, raise those children, the boys to be proper men, the girls to be proper ladies, to go and actually form the next generation of humanity? And I would venture to say, if we looked inwards, we would realize that, like everything else, but the Democrats, but the left, grading on a curve, we're better than them. But we could probably do a lot better. And I want to delve into some of the societal statistics on marriage and what I believe is behind the decline in marriage and fertility. You know, as we approach kind of a slow news week, I figured we'd do something a little bit more thematic today. But first, our sponsor today, speaking of April showers bringing May flowers, you gotta plant flowers for them to grow. And that's why I recommend fastgrowingtrees.com. It's actually my wife's favorite sponsor of the show. She's just got another shipment of indoor plants. So believe it or not, they have a great assortment of both outdoor and indoor plants. We just ordered their avocado and lime trees for indoor. I have a bunch of azaleas and rhododendrons, as well as a crepe myrtle outside, and they are fast growing. They are very high quality, and they're shipped to your door very quickly as well. It's always a pain to transport them back from the store. They kind of fall and get decapitated. And the thing is that they have a 30-day alive and thrive guarantee. Often you'll plant something, you know, this stuff is often expensive, and it doesn't grow. You get nothing out of it. So you know, you don't even need a lot of space for this stuff. You can grow, like I said, lemon, avocado, olive, or even fig trees in your home itself if you're one of those living in an apartment. But certainly your slice of heaven is your property as you still have it. It's time to beautify it today by going to fastgrowingtrees.com. Use offer code conservative at the checkout to get an additional 15% off. Again, this spring, they have the best deals online, up to half off on select plants and deals. And they make it easy to curate, you know, based on whether you want privacy, shade, beautification. And again, listeners get an additional 15% off with offer code conservative when you go to fastgrowingtrees.com. Offer is valid for a limited time. Terms and conditions apply, so make sure you gobble that up today, just like my wife just did. So, you know, one of the people we follow, Toby Rogers, he put out a post. This is the weirdest era in human history by far. Nothing else even comes close. Billionaires trying to kill everyone, civil society unable to form a coherent thought, institutions lie in smoldering ruins, poison handed out like candy. We are Neanderthals with iPhones. And I was thinking, how did we become like that? And there's several coexisting factors that amalgamate, and I think they form one chemical compound of dystopian hell. But it all gets back to the beginning, to Genesis. God created man and he created woman. That forms the foundation for the most important relationship, which forms the foundation for family, which of course forms the foundation of any successful society, culture, economy. Everything gets back to marriage. But in my view, the single biggest reason marriage is failing is because of particularly white Western society's relentless war on womanhood and motherhood. It's the blurring of the differences between genders. And by the way, this was before we took a look at a 6'3" Bruce and called him a Caitlin with a straight face, even on the right. That's even before that. And this is the broader problem on the right that I hinted at to this point yesterday with conservatives praising Title IX and the whole she-jock culture, the whole girl power culture, you know, but just don't take it to this degree that the left has taken it. And in essence, that's where we are pretty much in every policy or societal issue. We inculcate ourselves, our families, our minds, our souls, our bodies with leftist demonic dogma, but then we, you know, jump back maybe one or two tranches and then fight over it. But the entire construct of the last two generations of women, of womanhood, is demonic. It's time we be honest with ourselves about that. Kind of a continuation of the show I did last month on this, the war on femininity. You can't have proper relationships if you don't have a clear understanding of what is a man and what is a woman. And I don't just mean in its most evident literal sense that, I mean, there's plenty of people that won't point to a guy with a penis and say, Caitlin, but it's still this, yeah, our girls need to go and look up to the she-jocks and the this famous aggressive woman. And, you know, it's kind of like, we talk about a lot in criminology with if you're a black boy, 10, 12 years old, and you watch this culture of your older brothers, 18, 20, just doing a bunch of crime, getting away with it, and then, you know, they get reared into it. It's a similar thing, I think, with white women. This whole power girl culture has confused a generation of young girls that they have natural instincts, obviously, to be feminine, but then society is so geared towards extirpating all feminine traits, except for where they don't belong, of course, you know, from today's girls, that they grow up that with literally the sense you're the same, a unisex transhumanist bot culture. Now, you might think it runs in both directions, and it does, making men more feminine, but I think largely, A, that is downstream from making women more masculine, and I think it's also, it's more subtle, so a lot of people don't get it. Like, it still is taboo, I mean, in a lot of circles, if you have boys acting girly, you may say, like, you're acting girly. Whereas the other way around, there's no taboo anymore. Even among people that call themselves traditional families, you know, God-fearing, Christian conservatives, whatever. And you look at this generation of young girls, and what's being given over to them is that you are literally everything that a man does, you do. And it's part of this broader culture of going off the cliff where we had an enlightenment. You know, its roots in the Renaissance and then really crystallizing in the 1800s, 1900s. And then, you know, you could decide to varying degrees where you want to draw the line since the 80s, 90s, certainly 2000s, just going off that cliff. Obviously, you know, its seeds are in the 60s, the sexual revolution, just completely going off the cliff, conflating enlightenment with progressivism, where, yeah, women, you know, have equal opportunity participation, but still we recognize they're not freaking men. And I don't just mean like people on the right think, oh, so you mean we're not going to have the he-jocks with the she-jocks? Like, no. There's more to life than female sports. I'm sick of that being the defining issue of our time. As much as I disagree with the notion, obviously, of men being in female sports, but the notion that sports in general is a religion and certainly female sports is a little bit bizarre to me, but it's a lot more than that. You know, for example, think about growing up in a typical public school, middle school, high school. What's given over to the girls is your career is going to be 100% on par with that of a male. And what I mean by that is this. What I mean is, once a man starts working, whatever age that is, full-time, whenever a man starts working full-time, 22, 23, 24, whatever it is, pretty much until he retires, he's going to constantly work full-time. There's going to be no other major distraction, unless there's something unusual, he has health issues or whatever, and he's going to go all out to, you know, if he's a high achiever, to do everything he can to climb the ladder, earn more money, work harder. Sometimes that requires for certain years working more than full time, which a lot of people do. Has its own pitfalls to it. I'm just saying reality. And there's no interruptions, no period of time. Well, you know, from 25 to 40 or 30 to 45, I'm maybe going to do work 3/4 time, half time. No, I mean, doesn't work that way. You know, that's just how it is. For a woman now, it's like viewed as the same thing. You go, girl. And again, like I said, it doesn't mean you can't have a career, can't have a long-term career. But the reality is, if you're going to perpetuate society, and, you know, we always lament that we're not replacing ourselves and no one's having kids, no one's getting married, and even if they do, they don't have kids, don't have enough kids. It doesn't go with the you go girl culture. Again, there's plenty of ways you could work from home, part-time, and certainly full-time in all the years that you're not, you don't have young kids at home, which is a lot, you know, a little bit before, and then all the years afterwards, when the kids are a little bit older in school, some of them are out. But the notion that you're going to work full-time, never sacrifice any opportunity at any stage of life, even in the prime child-rearing age, you could make that work here and there, but as a general rule, if that is how you orient girls becoming women in society, you're going to get, what we kind of have today. And it really all starts with a mindset. So I want to throw at you a bunch of different data points and stuff I've been gathering just following certain polling and also some of the work from the Institute for Family Studies. This one is from a study of New York University's Jonathan Haidt and Zach Rausch. This is by 2020. So this was already pre-COVID. Because I want to make sure we're not blaming everything just on the COVID lockdowns. More than one in four girls between 12 and 17 reported having a major depressive episode in that year. That was 145% increase since 2010. Just 10 years prior. Again, before COVID. We're talking about pre-COVID baseline. One in four. Obviously, you know, you fast forward a couple years, and this is a little bit different of a measure. It's not a severe episode. It's just having been diagnosed with depression, nearly 37% of women report having been diagnosed with depression at some point in their lifetime. You understand that? That's more than a third. Why am I singling out women? Because that's almost twice the rate among men, which is 20%. Still crazy high. And again, the rate among women has doubled since 2017. No, I'm sorry. It has risen nearly twice the rate of men since 2017, according to Gallup. And the curve and the gender gap get steeper the younger you get in age. Very interesting. You get above 65, there's not that much of a gender gap, only a little bit, which is historically, obviously, you know, women suffered a little bit more from depression, but the gap grows much greater. Literally, it's a straight line, like a lot of things are in society. Every societal rock cut, the older you get, you know, the more healthier, more conservative, you go down, 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 down. So you can't blame this all on the lockdowns. A, it predated it, and B, what's with this accelerating gender gap? And to me, this is the essence of what is a woman. Why do you think Matt Walsh, you know, did his famous documentary on that, not What is a Man? I mean, we're having trannyism swing both directions. I mean, I don't know if it's more in one or the other. I haven't looked it up. Maybe it is, but no, this is something that has been building our entire lives. You know, when I was a kid, it was still being governed by the previous generation, but it was already, we were sowing the seeds. And now, you know, we've been reaping that before the demonic chapter of the Fourth Reich the last couple of years. And to me, it is obvious the culprit. Because there's confusion for everything. There's a confusion about the role of a man. There's a confusion about everything. Nothing is going right in society. But to me, the most glaring thing is there is a basic confusion in what it means to be a woman. Everyone knows that. Everyone knows that. It's in every part of culture bombarding young girls on things that negate, stifle, and destroy their femininity. I think a lot of what you see with men is they're very confused because everywhere they go, women are on the same level. I don't mean equality of opportunity, but just treated literally the same way. So they get very confused. And anyone knows you approach a marriage with that sort of mentality, you're done. Okay? A man has to be a giver and a woman is a receiver. Doesn't mean in its most literal sense you just receive all day. It means you take, harness, and beautify. When those traits are completely screwed over, that's how you get people not getting married. If they do, they have horrible marriages. They don't have kids. If they do, the kids are messed up. It's that single confusion to me is something that as God-fearing conservatives, we need to look inwards and look in our own families. Do we have a little bit of that illness in our own lives and how to rectify that. Because that is the only way we're ever going to grow out of this. The Institute for Family Studies, there's a piece, a fairly recent piece by Lyman Stone that he noted in his punchline that based on the trajectory, in a bunch of ways of projecting this, because remember, all the statistics you have now, as bad as they are, the statistics on marriage and childlessness, that's like our generation. Okay? Upper 30s, 40s, project out to those that are rising men and women today. What is that going to look like? The generation zombie, generation TikTok. Plausibly, 1 in 3 men and women, 1 in 3 who turn 45 in 2050, meaning those who are about 18, 19 today, will not have married. I want you to understand, you could cut off all illegal immigration. You could rectify every economic problem. Inflation, invasion, but it's the indoctrination that will kill us within. And again, it's not just the transgenderism du jour, but perhaps transgenderism de facto. I'm sorry, but that's what it is. Yeah, we understand within the margin, certain people, you're a little bit more of a tomboy, you're a little bit this, you have your hobbies here, you have your mentality like that, but generally, if we're going to continue this cultural shift of eschewing traditional gender roles, again, not in the super extreme stereotypes that the left likes to create a straw man. You know what I mean? I'm not talking about going back to the 1700s, pre-Enlightenment. We're talking about the peak of Enlightenment. I don't know where you want to put that. 1980s era, you know, the way we, you know, grew up. Which one's more draconian? Which one's better for women when they were happier? And again, that was far into women going to college and even law school, medical school in large numbers and doing all sorts of things already that generation. But there still was an understanding. Generally, if you were a healthy family, you would, you know, as a woman, at least on par with a career goal, if not greater, would be, I certainly want to start a family. How I'm going to balance that and, you know, over what years and when, that's going to depend on the, you know, some will, you know, never really have a substantial career outside of their home. Some will, you know, do part-time here. There's different ways. But in the mindset, that's how it was done. Just to understand how far we've fallen. This is again from Lyman Stone. In 1920, 70% of 25-year-old women and 50% of 25-year-old men had been married. Men typically got married later, but even then, 50% were already married at 25. Okay, so 70% of women, 50% of men. Now, we go back to 1920 because ironically, you might think, oh, well, that's a long time ago. Actually, if you go to 1967, it's much more. Because the baby boom coming back from the war, actually it was 85% of 25-year-old women were married, 75% of men. That was kind of an anomaly that was greater than usual. So even if you want to go back to a baseline of 70-50 by 25, do you know that today, not in 2050, today, just 20% of 25-year-old women and 23% of 25-year-old men are married. So by the way, notice the inversion there. In addition to the numbers being so low, there's actually slightly fewer women married. Again, that makes no sense historically when you have a benchmark for 25 because generally, I mean, I'm the same age as my wife. My wife's actually 40 days older. But, you know, generally, it's a lot more common for men to be older, even somewhat significantly older, 4 or 5 years older than women are older than men are the same age. So so often they'll marry older, they'll be older when they get married. So to have it inversed, that means that there's just a generation of women. Again, it's both directions, but I think the core catalyst is starting with the women. They clearly don't want to get married. You understand what a drop that is. We went from 85% of women being married in 1967 at 25 to just 20%. Now you might think, all right, well, you know, that's old-fashioned thing, get married early, okay, fine. You'll get married later at least, maybe by 30. No. Ever married shares today, meaning the share that it has ever been married, are at historic lows for 35-year-olds, for 45-year-olds, men and women. For instance, only about 60% of 35-year-old men are ever married today, down from 90% in 1980. So this is not a matter of delaying the age. And again, this is this generation. You look at the rising teens turning into men and women, the trajectory is going to be, you know, get even more demonic. You can't recover from this. Pew poll. Among young adults without children, so 18 to 35, men are more likely than women to say they want to be parents someday. Among those who don't have children yet, but they're age 18 to 35, 57% of men say they want children. Now, that's a problem. You think about that. You're 18 to 35, you don't have children, and only 57% of men are sure that they want to have children someday. That's pretty demonic, right? Well, just 45% of women say that they want to have children in the future. At that age. Again, that's an inversion. There was always a maternal instinct. What's missing with that? You see what I mean? The trends are all across the board, both genders. But it's even more severe to the point of being inverted from its traditional baseline among women. 73% of those who have never been married say they don't feel pressured to get married. Again, this is from Pew. So, you know, again, folks, we talk about the economic factors. I want to get to that in a minute. We talk about the demographics with, you know, illegals. And yeah, obviously, it exacerbates it. And when you have the native society not having kids, and then you import the only people who do have kids are radically different from your culture, then yeah, I mean, that's just going to accelerate the demise of your culture. But to be clear, immigration has nothing to do with this. That's a separate issue. This is an internal cultural problem that we have. And again, when you're talking about what is behind this mentality, there's another interesting article from the Institute for Family Studies. Just a couple weeks ago came out, Rosemary Hopcroft. More babies for the rich, the relationship between status and children is changing. So, again, very interesting thing. In the US and the UK, there is also a positive relationship between personal income and the number of children for men, such that higher income men have more children on average. So she's tracing this trend historically and throughout a bunch of countries and then goes to the US and UK. But also in Asia, that the more a man's earning power is, the more it has a positive correlation with fertility rates or, you know, having children. In the US and the UK, where there is more fertility outside of marriage, meaning as opposed to like Korea, but most children are born to married parents, much of the higher fertility of higher income men is because these men are more likely to marry. Okay? Makes sense. But then you flip over to women, and it's fascinating. There's a crisscross chart. For women in the US, there is an emerging U-shaped relationship between education and fertility. However, as in many countries, there is still a negative relationship between personal income and fertility for women, such that high-income women tend to have fewer children than low-income women. Okay? So you have the opposite dynamic. Most of the negative relationship between personal income and fertility for women in the U.S. likely represents trade-offs women face between earning income and bearing and raising children. There is borne out by the data from Sweden, where these trade-offs are ameliorated by generous state benefits for parents. Both parents each receive 8 months in paid paid parental leave while being paid 80% of their salary. While including such benefits in total income means that there is positive relationship between income and fertility for both men and women, when earnings from work are examined, excluding all the benefits and transfers from the state, high-earning women still have fewer children than lower-income women. The negative relationship between earnings from work and the number of children for women is because childless women are more likely to work outside the home. And, you know, what they note, what's very fascinating in this article is she notes that there's this trend that the left and even the so-called right pro-family people are trying to push of pro-family economic policies. The child care and the, you know, paid leave. And it's all designed to basically say we're going to have two full-time workers even during the childbearing age, but we'll give you some paid leave off right when they're born, and we'll make sure we really child care is a whole demonic cartel. Again, I'm not saying it doesn't have its time and place for various stages of life for people, whatever, but the way it's being pushed. And then, for example, you know, that the Republican House under Johnson, they just passed this bill that traded extending some of the Trump business tax cuts for a greater expansion of the refundable portion of the child tax credit. And I was like, look, you want to cut taxes, cut taxes. You want to give welfare because a lot of these people, it's a negative tax liability. They actually make money off it for if you're below a certain income level. Then say so. But the notion that this is an economic problem, the reason where women aren't getting married and having children, it's not. It's a mentality. It's a cultural problem. You're not going to primarily solve it with this. Now, to be clear, among the small remaining people who want to live traditionalist lives, this demonic inflation created by these policies has made it increasingly tough for women not to have to just, even if they don't want to try to pull in more income. And that is, and a lot of people do fall into that. But at its core, among most of the people who don't want to do the marrying and having the children, it's not for economic reasons. And she notes, very simply, a better approach is to accept that there are differences between men and women with regards to social behaviors such as sex and parenting. Work-family policies such as those in the Nordic countries largely ignore these differences and are aimed at facilitating full-time female employment. In part, this is a reaction to a history of patriarchal rules that limit the rights of women. Again, that's pre-Enlightenment. Yet there is a difference between eliminating barriers to female participation in the workforce and incentivizing equal employment outcomes for men and women. While laws and policies that limit opportunities for women are unwarranted, stipulating that all workplaces must have the same proportion of men and women, or incentivizing or otherwise encouraging men and women to act in exactly the same way will likely have negative consequences. Again, it's very simple. It's very simple. And obviously they note that better public schools, crime prevention, creation of safe neighborhoods, and actually having free market healthcare and reducing prices so that we could return to a traditional family model. And again, what a traditional family model means, it doesn't mean a woman can't have a career outside of child raising and bearing and homemaking. But what it means is that because she has that responsibility, which is a lofty responsibility, in many respects greater than that of a man, because that is the entire society is built off of that. So you could build your parallel career as quickly as or as slowly or as much or as little as you want at your own pace without the added pressure, either societally or economically, that I must do this in addition. Again, I know all these stories about people, oh, I make it work. But again, you're either you're going to have to sacrifice something in your career. Even if you do work, you're going to have to slow down what you could otherwise do if you were a man, which is what you're going to have to do. Or you're going to have a tranche not getting married, a tranche not having children, or if they do, they're not raised properly. You could have exceptions. You could have people that make it work. Absolutely. But if you take a petri dish of 100,000 families where the wife is primarily available during those kind of formative childbearing and raising years, 20s, 30s, you know, versus those that are pedal to the metal, you know, at least 40-hour work week outside the home, there's no question it's going to come out of having the kids, and if you do, the quality of raising them, right? On average, in that, you know, pool of 100,000 in a, you know, study and control group, that's obvious. And these are some of the realities that a lot of these girl boss conservative influencers don't want to broach, but it's a no-brainer. It's a disgusting mentality that it's not even like it's on par. Okay, let's say I'm a 9th, 10th, 11th grade girl in a public school today. The message that's being conveyed to you, it's not even an option. Okay, to primarily have the husband marry a good husband, is going to take care of you. You know, yeah, you have talents. It might fully manifest in a career as well. But that taking care of the home and the children is going to be the loftiest goal. And, you know, the other stuff will kind of work around that rather than vice versa. That somehow you're a loser. You're downright a loser for doing that. And I don't view it that way, and neither should you. I'll just talk about my own situation. So my wife and I got married at 23, almost 24, and, you know, had four kids. And she was working, you know, pretty much about 40 hours a week at the time when she was single, doing technical illustrations. And still worked after we got married and we had our first kid. But then by the second kid already, it got too hard. So, you know, for a number of years, pretty much just took off. And then now she's starting to do, again, from the comfort of home, that's the beauty. Nowadays you could do a lot, freelance illustrations and slowly building it up. Because our, you know, youngest is going out until 2, and next year will be even more. She'll be in school. But the mentality all along is that that is the main thing you do. And I will tell you, if as conservatives, we want to outnumber and outbreed the bad guys and rebuild our civilization, it's not going to be enough to get married and have one or two kids. I'm just going to tell you that. You're going to need more like 4 or 5, at least 3. You know, it's not for everyone, but I'm just saying that is, in a macro sense, what we need to be encouraging. And I'm just going to tell you, as a father of 4 kids, you know, I have so many things I wish my wife could do. Oh, this needs to be taken care of, that. There's never a free minute. It's not like she's sitting down. I mean, this is before she was even, you know, in her spare time taking on clients and doing work. Even when she worked 0 hours for a number of years, between driving the carpools and just the shopping, the food shopping, just the basic stuff, it goes by. You know, and I think this is a very important thing that needs to be imbued in today's daughters. Salary.com, they seem to put this out every few years. You could Google it. They have a certain methodology of calculating the monetary value of a stay-at-home mother and homemaker. If that was a paid salary and the just amalgamation of different jobs, different hats they wear. And this was in 2021. As you well know, the inflation has gone through the roof since then. Came out to a salary of $184,820. So let's say for right now, let's call it an even $200,000 with inflation. Okay? That, my friends, is a girl boss. That is a girl boss. $200,000 salary there. Except it's much greater because rather than bringing in that money, which hopefully the husband's able to earn enough, again, now in this demonic economy, it's very hard. But ideally, you are building God's kingdom. You're building what we don't have today, what we used to have, and yet we destroyed. This is the central societal point that we just refuse to recognize. And again, it's all cultural and societal. This is from the Financial Times, just came out. Interesting article from John Byrne Murdoch. Why family-friendly policies don't boost birth rates. And again, kind of the same observation. Between 1980 and 2019, the world's most developed countries roughly tripled their real terms per capita spending on child benefits, subsidized childcare, parental leave, and other family-friendly policies. And I say that with air quotes. They sell it as that. It's just a way to demonically structure society that you have to have two full-time earners in perpetuity. Over that same period of time, those same countries saw a declining birth rate from 1.85 to 1.53. In egalitarian Finland, home to some of the most family-friendly policies in the world, fertility rate has fallen by a third just since 2010. Hungary, famous for its extravagant payouts aimed at boosting the nation's number of babies, fewer children were born last year than at any time since records began. Korea, which obviously is like the lowest birth rate around, they're famous for a famous government baby bonus, was found to have mainly paid out to women who are already planning on having children. In other words, it didn't grow the pie. Okay, so the same people, that the minority that were having children, now you give them a bonus. Analyzed across all rich countries, birth rates are no higher among those where childcare is fully subsidized than those where parents pay eye-watering fees. The link between births and total spending on family-friendly policies is negligible. This often prompts head-scratching, but it should not. Unsurprisingly, perhaps, the decision on whether to have children and how many if so turns out to be far more than money. To be clear, family-friendly policies can have other positive impacts on individuals and society. They make it easier for those who have already chosen to have children to juggle family and work. They alleviate poverty. But when it comes to heavy lifting on birth rates, culture is far more powerful than policy, often exerting its influence several steps before the point. And I don't think he has the guts to say what I'm saying, but what he means is it's several points before. It's in the way we raise our girls. That is the culprit. That is the number one thing. Now, you might say, concurrently, it's the godlessness of society, and a godless society raises girls that way. I don't know if it's the chicken or the egg, and we could talk about that, or it's concurrent, but religiosity and our family values of our conception of femininity, womanhood, motherhood, that is the antecedent to every societal problem. Right there. No question about it. And then, of course, yeah, I mean, when you throw in the fact that it's Muslim immigrants to England that are the only ones having kids, then you're screwed. This is from the UK critic, Miriam Cates. The UK's TFR, their fertility rate has been declining since the 70s, but the news that the average British woman is now having just 1.59 children is a cause of significant concern. And she talked about how they basically plugged the gaps with immigration. Massive levels of immigration. But the point is, so when you look at those numbers like 1.49, it's severely distorted. You have to narrow it down to what about white females, let's say, or, you know, native females that, you know, not from immigrant families. You'll go down even further. And again, yeah, I mean, like I've said before, this is from Gallup, changes in frequency of U.S. religious service attendance over the past two decades. So, you know, do you attend services every week? Okay. All U.S. adults went from basically 42 to 30% in about 20 years, 20-year window. It was already on the decline very much throughout the 90s, but a net loss of 12 points, 42 to 30 overall. And they break down all the major denominations of religion, and each religion saw a loss. So, for example, Protestants saw a loss of a net loss of 4. Now, it doesn't break it down by mainline and evangelical. Catholic, of course, saw a drop of 12. Massive drop. Christian Orthodox saw a drop of 9. A category of other saw a drop by 24. I'm not sure what that is. And ironically, there's only two religions that saw an increase. But it's really only one in many respects, if you think about it. And it's, if you know what I mean, the wrong one. Islam has a gain of 4. Meaning, remember, we're not talking about, you might think, oh, yeah, well, we have a lot more Muslims. Yeah, but that's not what the measure is. Because the measure is whatever pie of Muslims we had in 2020 versus 2022, whatever, not 2000 versus 2020 decade, the current decade, what was the percentage of the American Muslim population that attended services once a week? That rose. So in other words, it's not just we're having more Muslims, they're getting more religious, which you might be, well, Daniel, more religious. Well, no. If everyone else gets less religious and they get more, well, good luck. I think we know what that means. Now, ironically, the other one, the biggest jump was actually Judaism, but it's a little bit of a misnomer because, again, it's just that the share of the composition of Orthodox has gotten greater because non-Orthodox are either intermarrying or not having kids, not getting married, and basically co-signing themselves to oblivion. So, you know, it was just 15%. That's how low it was among Jews because they're extremely secular in 2020. Two decades later, it's actually up to 22. That's roughly probably the share that Orthodox compose of the Jewish pie, probably about 1 in 5. But that, believe it or not, that's more than it was 20 years ago. So that's really what that is. It's kind of a bait and switch there. But I mean, and look, I mean, just to speak about my own religion for a minute, and I think it is something that Christians can learn from. I would say, unfortunately, you know, as biblical Jews, you know, every societal ill has crept in on some level, much lower level than the general society. I mean, you know, when I was growing up in my private Jewish school, it was like we had one kid that was from a divorced family. Now you got, you know, one or two in each class. It's a percentage already. It's small percentage. It's much smaller than the general population creeping in. But I would say one of the things that I know I believe we do right is we do have very clearly defined traditional gender roles. And I think that really is the antecedent to getting married, having a good marriage, having kids, and not having a bunch of depressed, you know, females that just don't know where, you know, if they're coming or going. And again, I know, you know, the left and, you know, they'll throw a bunch of canards, oh, you're a bunch of backwards, whatever, but it's not. I mean, plenty of them have, you know, high-powered careers and do all sorts of things, but in the mindset and the culture, the pressure is among biblical Jews, in my community, you know, if you're a young woman, you want to get married, you want to have kids. Some will have more of a robust career, some won't, but that is always a priority. And I think that really is the number one thing that, you know, generally the Christian world needs to get back to if we're ever going to rebuild America. And that really leads me with the final point I wanted to make. Lyman Stone has another article from a couple years ago, 2020, on the fertility advantages for conservatives. And it's both good news and bad news. And it's interesting. You look down, he does break down the numbers. I always wondered this, and I did some searching on their website, and I found this article. I was like, do we have a birth rate of conservative versus liberal? Now, I don't think we really have a number, but what he did do on a scatter diagram is take, I guess he'd use maybe the 2016 voting tally. So again, this is not perfect expression of this, but if you take Trump versus Hillary counties, so you know, you plot on a graph the 3,000 counties, their birth rates versus you know how much you have an 80% Trump county versus a 20% Trump county, found a very, very strong R squared correlation. But again, it's all relative. It's only to a certain, you know, certain degree. It's not a high birth rate, and it's declining. It's declining everywhere. It's declining at the same rate as the left. It's just from a higher baseline. He writes, the decline in birth rates around the country in recent years may present a challenge for conservative politicians. Delayed and reduced transition into marriage and parenthood will result in young adults spending more years with more liberal ideologies, you know, because the notion is that it's kind of a push-pull. More conservatives get married earlier, but also marriage does turn you more conservative. It will be increasingly difficult to build constituencies around conservative social priorities in a world where fewer young adults are at a point in life where those priorities make sense with their life situation. And again, remember, it's in the news today with the Florida Supreme Court greenlighting what some are concerned is a very misleading language for one of these left-wing ballot initiatives to create a right to abortion in the Florida Constitution. We're having this in a bunch of other states. And, you know, we're really losing on that issue. There's a lot to say about that. But, you know, when you have a lot of people that are designed to resent parenthood and never get married, never have children, it's going to breed this sort of mentality where you just obsess about abortion, even if you yourself are not getting one. But there's a final point here I want to read to you that's, again, a haunting warning to us that we need to just start looking inwards. Finally, this conservative fertility advantage probably will not give conservatives some inevitable long-term political edge. Fertility rates are falling for conservatives just as much as liberals. Given the size of the fertility differential between conservatives and liberals, meaning it's not that great, it doesn't actually take a large amount of ideology switching to offset this higher birth rate. Thus, while conservatives may wish that their fertility advantage could afford a durable political majority, that hope is probably just as fleeting as the now silly-sounding claims of progressives a decade ago that immigration would create a durable Democratic majority. That's because, at least right now, conservative parents have not been sufficiently successful in keeping their kids in the fold. Keeping their kids in the fold. That is our job. See what I mean? You don't control, you know, the Texas governor, certainly Congress and, you know, Trump and the rhinos and the Democrats, but you control your own destiny. You control your own destiny. It's that simple. And look, I want to be very clear. Some people, you know, you're stuck with a troubled kid from the day he's born, or kid maybe is not troubled in terms of getting into drugs and crime, but, you know, becomes a liberal. And not everyone, you know, that's why it says in the Bible that, you know, you don't suffer. Children do not suffer for their father's sins and vice versa. Because at the end of the day, they have their own free will. But again, if I have a petri dish of 1,000 families, conservative parents, where in one group, 1,000 of them put their thumb on the scale in every aspect of raising their kid, imbuing them in that liberalism is demonic, and not just in sort of like, you know, a political posture way, but to live that. And part of that is not this, you go girl, like, yeah, yeah, you know, she jock stuff. Again, you can have your hobbies, it's fine. But in general, you raise your boys to be good men and your wife in particular takes the lead on raising your daughter to be a proper lady, I promise you, on average, you take the 1,000 and what percentage stay within the fold, it's going to be off the charts greater in the group where you actually put your thumb on that scale. And this is what we need to focus on within our own dominion. I say this all the time. A lot of times we're like, we're a minority. People often lament. Let's say conservatives in this country, I'm just going to make up, are 30%. But it's not the fact that we're only 30 but not 60 that's lamentable. It's the fact that qualitatively, is the 30 really a 30? Or is it more like 5? But we're all kind of fake. Because you see, part of why the left is so successful is that the demonic left at any given generation, relative to the Overton window, they don't have 51%. They don't have 30%. It's more like 10%. Maybe in this generation, they have more like 20. But man, are they core. They believe an irate, relentless minority could do anything. Remember, you take the most conservative counties that we in this country and states, and we actually not just, you know, like we do on most shows, we'll go back to tomorrow, focus on our political activism and not electing, you know, fake Republicans, but to not live fake conservative lives ourselves. And yes, if you're a father and a mother of daughters, that begins in the mentality of how you raise your daughter to exalt womanhood, embrace her feminine traits, embrace and glorify motherhood, which it is. It is God's glory. You know, 50, 70 years ago, it might have looked very enticing. Yeah, go girl. We're going to change society. You look back like a person who wakes up in a drunken stupor from a hangover, all broken. Even the left has to admit, what did we get for it? Broken families, broken society, confused individuals. The genders can't even relate to each other. And if you don't have Genesis 3, well, the entire Tower of Babel falls from there. So a little bit off the beaten path today. Hope you guys enjoy it. Maybe we'll do more. Let me know if you have good guests. Particularly, I'm looking for female guests to talk about this point. It's something that we need more of an educated discussion on, you know, without these fake stereotypes and extremes and strawman arguments that, you know, want to make traditional motherhood undesirable. It's something that I think we all need to look inward in how we raise our own children. Again, it doesn't mean they can't go to college, can't go to law school, medical school, whatever it is. But that they don't view themselves with every last thing in society on par with a man. You do that, you get what we have. You continue doing that, you're going to continue this degenerative trend. And we can congratulate ourselves that we're as family-oriented as the Democrats were in 2010. But if that's where we are, and then in 2030 or 2040, we'll be where the liberals are today, that's the road to hell. We need to reverse that trend that is within our power, within our families, our churches, and our communities. But at the end of the day, you can only change the world one person at a time. That begins in your own household. Let me know what you think about today's show. Daniel Horowitz at startmail.com. That's S-T-A-R-T, not star, but startmail.com. Till tomorrow, God bless y'all, and thank you for listening.